Welcome to Polycast, an official podcast of a Poulton Civilization site.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-hosts.
Snoopy369.
K-A-R-O-B-E-R.
R_Robo1.
Listen to an episode of Polycast the same again, though, will you? Because you'll know what got cut.
This Polycast does not resemble what you recorded.
Creative censorship was used.
Number 62. I am Joe Snoopy369 Matisse, here with Dan Q.
Yes.
Imran.
Hi.
Makalua.
Hey.
James Robertson.
Hey.
And Rolo.
Hi, people.
Carter Rolo. And you're listening to Polycast.
Still.
Man. Still.
What is wrong with you people? Most hilarious message ever, started by Lord Ellis in January of 2006, but resurrected by CDC 989 on February 1st. A lot of people cited the Caesar saying, "Would you like some salad? I made it myself." I like that one because I find it funny without being crude or sexually suggestive.
I don't know, I'm always rather fond of Stalin has converted to Judaism.
My favorite was one that happened with when I contacted him right in the beginning of the game. We were in capital contact, basically, and I contacted him in turn zero. It was, "Soon my number was no unit will kill you all."
No unit.
I went ahead and opened the XML file, and for those people who are interested in browsing all of them without actually having to encounter all of the people, you can go to in the your Civ4 folder, and then assets, and then text, and then Civ4 diplomacy text.xml, and that this is in the original Civ4 folder. And then, of course, the Warlord specific leaders are in the Warlords and Beyond the Sword, and the Beyond the Sword version with roughly the same title, diplomacy text something. The one that I saw that I think is the greatest is if you go to the Diplo Refuse to Talk leader Kublai Khan, his Refuse to Talk message is, "Hello, this is our name, our civ, is not at home right now. Please leave your name and number, and we'll get back to you when pigs have wings."
I never saw that one.
I've actually never seen that one in Civ either.
I like Louis the 14th. Forget it. I have wigs that are smarter than you are. Someone relayed when they said, "Frederick asked for metal casting for free." I say no. Frederick's response, "Well, dang."
We talked all about the Lonely Hearts Club, and Rolo gave us an in-depth look into that.
Lonely Hearts.
Not my title.
We also talked about on airlift and a thought on unique units.
In the Senate, we talked about Dan's best unique building list, or like I like to call it, the top 10 build reasons why Dan's only a mid-level Civ player. And we talked about our favorite map type. We learned how much Imran loves continents and how much Archipelago is apparently not an interesting map type to most of the people on the Polycast.
I resemble that remark.
So does Imran.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
To say about the Lonely Hearts Club. It's not even my idea.
Oh.
I stole it from Europax.
yeah, but you've taken it over effectively. You can't hide behind that. Oh, I didn't start it. That doesn't fly here. So, as described by Rolo1 on the forums, isolated starts, the ones in which you have at least one tile of ocean between the landmass where you're standing and the one where your nearest neighbor is, one of the most dreaded kinds of starts in Civilization IV. Most players developed a game strategy that requires neighbors. Isolated starts are exactly the opposite of early rushes. You normally have more than enough space and can plan city sites without urgency. Another issue is with diplomacy. For good or bad, you are away from the diplomatic nets that will flourish when you're not isolated. This means you can't trade technologies, bribe, or be a religious pal before first contact. But also means that there will not be hatred until first contact, that you can't lose or can't be forced to give in to anything through the Apostolic Palace and Beyond the Sword, and that you can trade more valuable technologies because you haven't touched the "we fear you are becoming too advanced" limit. Now, the Lonely Hearts Club, or LHC, was started in May of 2007 by Will Pax for Civilization IV Warlords. He hosted the first three, followed by Invisible Stalk for two. Then our Rolo 1, Ricardo here, held the sixth and final Warlords edition that September. Since then, all but a special Viking edition in the June of last year has been hosted by our Rolo 1, and they're currently on the 38th edition. The 39th edition is expected to start in mid to late February. The current game features Roosevelt as the leader, who was last seen in actually the fourth edition of the series on Warlords. Now, in addition to that, I've noticed that our Rolo 1 has some good general guidelines for anyone looking to pick up on one of these games, and that is, first and foremost, that none of the games are considered closed. If you want to play and or post in one of the previous games, feel free to. But if anyone is looking to go for another Warlords or even a vanilla Lonely Hearts Club, which as near as I could tell there never was a vanilla Lonely Hearts Club, you are welcome to do so, but Rolo 1 just isn't going to do it himself. Oh, and apparently there's no problem with defeats and reruns. Just play and enjoy. How is that as an introduction?
You made your homework, that's for sure. What I've noticed along those years is that there is not a week that passes that a player comes to the forums saying, "Help, I'm isolated!" Or something like, why there is not an isolated script for maps? Well, and the fact is that in Warlords and Vanilla, most of the players developed an X-Rush strategy. Make a bunch of X, kill, rerun. Make a bunch of X, kill, rerun. Or you can use Praetorians too. It's pretty much about the same thing. What I did know, this is when a dear friend of the All Readers Challenge coped with an isolated start. He went completely haywire. In the end, he was fighting tanks with grenadiers. That is not exactly the best position to have. That is why Will Pax started the Lonely Hearts Club. In fact, if you read all of them, you will notice there is a very thin evolution between all of them. Things about unique units, unfortunately unique units that appear before gunpowder, are completely worthless. In the end, people said it's actually the other way around. Well, the fact is that most of people don't know how to play without rushing a neighbor. In fact, it's not very uncommon to hear people saying, "Oh my god, I don't have a neighbor to rush. What should I do?" Most of the people simply don't know how to pace, how to micromanage, how to make things by themselves. And in fact, Civilization IV is a game that shuns really a lot of players that start isolated. You can see pretty easily what happens when an AI starts isolated. They adopt their regions and make a bunch of buildings, and they end dead or vassalized to someone else. Pretty much everyone in the older days, and even now, plays to kill the other neighbors. They don't have any neighbors, they will go haywire. That is why I made that article that you quoted most of the time.
With each of the editions of the Lonely Hearts Club, are you finding that you're getting the usual people contributing to the discussions? Like, do you have a loyal following, or...?
I must say that a lot of the good players that passed in the Civilization Fanatics Center already played the Lonely Hearts Club or two. They are rotating. Most of the people that started the Lonely Hearts Club aren't there anymore. We can see that some play, some don't, and we have to admit that most of the people that plays don't post the games there. It's a very time-intensive stuff, and most of the people don't have the patience for do that. I understand, I can see that we have roughly 10 or 20 people that post with some consistency in the games, but I can see the number of people that downloads the games.
How did you get involved in the Lonely Hearts Club, anyway? I take it when you picked up from Invisible Stalk after the second one that he did, what became the sixth and final Warlords edition. Did you really anticipate seeing yourself taking it over effectively, doing as many of the Beyond the Sword editions as you have done and continue to do?
Well, I had the plan to make a couple of ones and pass it to someone else, but it appears that most of the people simply prefer to play it, have the hard job of organizing whatever. You should know better than me. The fact is that making the saves, and I passed to World Builder saves for about in the half of the series, it was extremely hard to lose an afternoon or two making saves and posting them and all of that. When I passed to the World Builder saves, it became easier, but it's still a very time-consuming process because Fire Axis didn't give an isolated script. In fact, I should do one sooner or later because it would cut me a lot of work. Most of the people would probably shoot me by the net if I gave them some of the isolated sites. I've seen some other people posting in the games, like ones that you have space for three cities and you have to put one in every corner.
How would an isolation script like that really differ from using Archipelago or Hemispheres with small enough number of sieves and large enough number of hemispheres?
There is not much of difference. My games are normally tractor ones, and then I pass through a very tiresome analysis of maps trying to find one there is at least one civilization isolated. And then I normally switch places or simply cut an island or two. In some cases, it's very rare to do that. But Archipelago is quite different because Archipelago means that you can't be connected by some weird spot in the middle of nowhere that nobody noticed. Same with Big and Small Pits, that also makes a very good maps, but Highlands is more complicated. Highlands, 99% of the times, generated maps that you are isolated.
Big and Small, you mentioned Big and Small, that's interesting to me because the multiplayer that I play, played Big and Small a few times, and almost always one of the multiplayer people ends up being effectively isolated, either on the end of a mountain, you know, blocking them off, or just in the islands and not able to connect to the other people. And in multiplayer, it's particularly interesting. We play with no tech trading, so that takes away one of the big advantages of not being isolated. But you still end up with, if you're unable to connect to the other people, you're usually able to play a much more peaceful, builderish sort of game, whereas the people, you know, playing four or five other people on the same continent, they have to build all military and nothing else.
It has to be right that, or you buy someone to build the army for you. That is a very acceptable proposition too, but you can do that exactly with an AI that is not exactly the brightest creature on Earth.
I don't know, I find in isolated games I almost always end up behind one or more of the AIs. I'll go along blithely ignoring the rest of the planet until the Middle Ages sometimes, and then I'll find that I'm massively behind AIs.
You'll find that you're the Aztecs and the Spanish suddenly show up?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. It goes about as well for me as it did for them.
That happens a lot, you know. Yeah, when I started to play the Lonely Hearts Clubs, I played in Monarch, and it was not exactly unlikely to have 10, 15 sometimes techs behind. But if you have a sound economy, a nice economy behind, libraries, universities sometimes, if you have a decent terrain, you can play with the tech trades. That is most likely the bigger lesson in isolated starts. How to trade and how to play with the diplomacy. Not mentioning the Apostolic Palace swings that, even with dispatch, are simply, well, easy enough. When you start isolated, you don't trade for mathematics, you don't trade for aesthetics, you don't trade for alphabet. Because of that, you can trade by a theory, you can trade by assembly line, physics, even biology sometimes. Normally, you can do that. Of course, there's sometimes there is that super-uber AI that it's one neighbor, vassalizes the other three, and it's stacking rocketry when you start education. It already happened to me once, and it's not pretty. That one I haven't actually won, but at least I haven't been killed. The other part is diplomacy. Diplomacy is probably the most difficult part when you start in isolation. You aren't loved by anyone. You don't have their religion, you haven't battered them for 500 years or whatever. But you don't have exactly big enemies. Nobody hates you because, in fact, nobody knew that you were there. That allows you to play with the diplomacy in a way that normal games don't allow. You can start tech trading with some people, not start tech trading with others. You can leverage things in a completely different way. Other thing that is quite different is that all of your foreign trade routes are going to be intercontinental. That means if you have a good deal of harbors or the Great Lighthouse, when you get to astronomy, the profits will skyrocket. It's not uncommon to see people to not just decide one step up or two. If you rely on technologies like education, civil service, currency is very important, you can have a very solid empire, and when you finally get contact with everyone else, you are in good shape to catch the big guy. Of course, that implies that there is a big guy and not 10 big guys or 11 big guys and all hating each other and everyone asking one turn or two, join me in war with X when you can't even put a scout there.
You had mentioned about the economy and the use of harbors and your economy being contained within yourself when you're in isolated state and no contact with anybody else. A couple of episodes ago, we revisited our favorite civics, and we essentially poo-pooed mercantilism available at banking, except we said, well, it could probably be advantageous if you were on an isolated start. And as someone who has done quite a few isolated starts publicly, let alone games that you've just done on your own and never reported on, have you found that to actually be the case, that mercantilism is useful when mercantilism becomes available and you are still isolated, which is probably the case that you're still isolated because it comes before astronomy?
Well, coming before astronomy, not always. It is a very valid strategy when you are isolated to double bulb astronomy with the great scientists. I've seen a lot of people doing that, and it works quite well if you have the infrastructure behind. But most of the times, the fact is that banking is not a very important tech to get when you are isolated. It's okay, but there is more important thing to do. You need civil service to regate some spots. You need currency to be able to one more trade route and have the markets. You need code of laws, of course. You can't live with four cities alone unless you don't have space for more. You even need drama more than banking. Banking, I see most of the players trading for it after getting contact. It is not a bad civic. The problem is that you will not get there so easily. Banking needs guilds. The guilds needs feudalism. Both of them are very expensive techs that don't give much of input to the economy.
Have you ever considered doing something with multiplayer? Because multiplayer, both you have the actual starts, like you say, that where you're isolated, and you have games like Pitboss game I'm in right now, where I'm me against the rest of the world because I came out to too big of an early lead, and now everyone else is tech trading, and I'm falling way and way and way behind.
Been there, done that.
So have you ever considered doing a multiplayer version?
Maybe. In fact, nobody asked that to me before. I would do that, but humans are very, very different from the AI, and I'm particularly sure that the human that starts isolated will have not a very particularly happy ending.
Most of the time, right? Unless everyone else spent the entire time killing each other off and doing a very good job of it.
Unless you go completely vertical before everyone gets astronomy and you play a little game called Nuclear Annihilation. Been there, done that too.
I think Joe's volunteering himself to help you with that there, Rollo, getting that set up. Oh, very kind.
remember to pay you a beer someday.
Lift, otherwise known as lifting on air. Did you know that? It's true.
Oh, really?
S.K. Dyer says, I'm having a heck of a time finding a good post on the use of airlift in Beyond the Sword. Could some helpful soul please answer the following question? Does the destination city of an airlift have to have an airport?
Nope.
But as the Tephros says, you can no longer airlift to foreign cities in that case, not sure about vassals. What types of units can be airlifted? Any land-based unit.
You can airlift to teammates. I don't know if you can airlift to vassals or not.
Which air units can perform an airlift, or units that don't have anything to do with airlifting?
It's just the airport.
It's a good question, though.
But you could say, like, I don't know, like a Cessna, maybe? Just imagine what airplanes behind the airlift. He also has 2.3s.
I guess it's 3A and 3B. His second 3 is a constraint that only one unit can be airlifted per airport per turn. That's correct.
Yeah, if you have a lot of airports, you can shift a lot of guys at once, and you can send them all to the same city also.
Right, and the guy who answers the first questions, I think, is incorrect. Because he also says that you can only receive one per city, which is wrong, I'm fairly sure.
You can only send one unit to a city that doesn't have airports. Few cities have airports. It's like Psygate in Alpha Centauri or the airport in C3.
Right, then you can send as many as you want.
As long as they haven't been moved in the turn they are airlift.
And then, from a strategic aspect, is airlifting play an important and useful role in intercontinental movement and conquests?
Heck yes.
Yes.
Definitely.
How else are you going to get that infantry into a city quickly when you just rolled over it with tanks?
Yes, even your tank stack can just keep on rolling while you send in defensive troops in by airlift.
This is one of the cases where in Civ 4, not being able to sell improvements actually plays a big difference in your strategy, because if you're being attacked by someone, you'd have a huge incentive to get rid of your airports so that they don't take them over, since you can only receive one unit per turn as opposed to unlimited.
Yes, but everything is not going to actually win you the war. They can definitely speed up the reinforcement, right? But most of the times the war is already won when you can put an airport there, unless you are using universal suffrage and you can really put some cash into it. But you would still have to wait for Capture City to get out of revolt. That's why most of the people that use these kinds of strategies simply raise the first city that they capture and put directly a settler there for them to be able to cash rush the airport immediately. A big city can build a pretty easily about 10, 12, 15. It happened to me once, turns of revolt, and if you are going to bet on reinforcements by air until that happens, you have lost pretty much. Especially with the AI love for CR Siege, that is completely insane.
I have to say, multiplayer airlift doesn't really usually play a factor, but only because you don't usually get that far in a game. multiplayer, I find that the game is won, or effectively won, before you get to the point of airlift. That and the fact that usually, at least, the games that I play, typically we play on, have one continent, or at most two continents.
Yeah, this kind of lines up with the Lonely Hearts Club thing, that if you start isolated or near isolated, this comes into play much more frequently.
Pretty much. If you see some of the games of the main team, for example, that is a completely domination freak, I hope he doesn't hear that.
Don't listen to Polycast.
So he's okay with that. He normally plays for domination or conquest when he plays the Lonely Hearts Club, and in fact, most of the tricks I told you before, it came from there. The fact is that you can't live only with everything you are invading. If your spearhead doesn't hold one turn, everything is not going to save you. That is a big issue. But everything is very powerful if used right. In the moment you have an airport in both sides of the road, you basically have, like, having three types of roads between your land and the land of your enemy.
I definitely think, I mean, for what you're saying, and I think I agree with this, I would use it for reinforcements, and it certainly can be very useful for that reinforcements, because often you can lose your attack because you can't fill in your back cities. It allows you to continue pushing forward with your force and not worrying about leaving too many units behind to defend the cities. But I definitely, I mean, if I'm going to add an additional attacking force, that's going to come with transports. It's just, it takes too long sending only one unit per city unless you've got 50 or 60 cities. And if you've got 50 or 60 cities, you've probably got an even bigger army than that anyway. So, yeah, it just takes too long to send units over. And whereas the transport, you have 7 or 8 transports and you can bring
4 units per transport? 2 on a galley, 3 on a galleon, and 4 on a transport.
That is correct.
Transport, they're not expensive anyhow. Do you think it would be more realistic if each Civ had a unique unit per time period? This new waiver over on Civ Fanatics?
Do I need to have a spreadsheet handy whenever I'm playing the game, then?
It'd be annoying.
And don't they sort of already, because certain of the units can't be built until certain technologies, like Samurai, the replacement for Masonry, so you don't get it till the Medieval Age anyway.
But they're suggesting that you have a Samurai, and then you have some other unit that is a unique unit for the later era.
But what do you do for, like, the early era unique unit for the Americans? I mean...
We don't have a period earlier than musket men, so,
Yeah, it's kind of hard. Or even, like, the ancient period in Japan, you know? I mean...
What does Rome get for the modern era? I see some problems with this concept.
There are some mods that incorporate this, and like, you know, Rusty Edge mentions in the thread, there's the History in the Making mod. It's certainly not a particularly difficult thing to mod if it's something that people have interest in. The only difficulty really being designing the additional unit textures, but nothing saying you couldn't reuse an already existing unit.
And do you put an expiration date on the unique units then? You can only build them up till you reach Technology X and then they're unbuildable?
Well, I mean, who cares if it's an archer unique unit? I mean, who cares if you can build skirmishers in the modern day? You know, I'm not going to be building them.
Well, using archers could give us some interesting tricks. If you can do skirmishes in the modern ages, you can send them to battle something light to gain a lot of experience points, and that upgrade it would be far better than you making an infantry and trying to gain that misery one experience point per fight against a longbowman or something like that.
I like the interesting post here by Artificial J that they ask, you know, what would the modern Aztec unit be, since obviously the Aztecs don't exist, and he says, a nuke.
Nah, it would be Montezuma Revenge, biological weapon.
That would be an interesting one to add. You could replace the nuke with the biological weapon.
Well, technically, we have the poisoning of the well still.
It's spies, yeah.
The poisoning of the well is technically a biological weapon, but that is another point.
That's true, yeah.
Effectively, right now, most unique units we have, they do become obsolete in the sense that eventually there's a unit that's going to replace it, and you're not going to be able to build any new ones anymore. You're just going to have the ones that you already have, if you have any.
That is plainly annoying when you are playing, for example, the Portuguese or the Dutch, because their unique unit is pretty interesting to use with Marines. Have you already used an East Indiaman or a Carrack full of Marines to raise a cultural city?
We've talked before about whether or not you should still be able to build units that are now considered technologically obsolete, and in some cases you can have it so that you can disconnecting one or more of your cities from the rest of your trade network, denying them access to, say, a particular resource would mean that, oh, you can continue to build those Oromo warriors, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the one that comes to mind. But on the topic itself here, as I said, no, and for reasons that have already been stated, which is, and I think it's well spoken by...
Tailless Kangaroo.
Where the original idea behind unique units is that they allow civilization to specialize in a certain way or be especially powerful during a certain period in the game, generally corresponding roughly to the period that Civ was the most powerful in real history. Having a unique unit for each period of history, while it would make the game somewhat more interesting, sort of spoils the game mechanism, quote-unquote. But what I do like is Super 49er's suggestion, where a proposed unique unit for each leader instead of each civilization.
That's true, and that allows you to play the civils, even if you really want to play the English or whatever, but you can play them differently if you have a red coat versus the English longbowman or whatever you want to, would call that versus the Winston Churchill would be like the some airplane or something. Yeah.
Spitfire. So, first suggestion in the thread, if I recall correctly, from Rusty Edge suggested that gives Churchill a Spitfire and Vicky a Dreadnought.
Dan, one thing I from what you just said a minute ago, the disconnecting resources, it connects well to one of our earlier topic about the gunpowder units not having City Raider. You notice how you can't take away Grenadiers because there's no saltpeter like there was in Civ 3. I think there's a reason for that, and that actually makes it so you can't go backwards at that point.
Pretty much.
For that very reason. Once you've got Riflemen and Grenadiers, you can't go back and build Macemen, give them City Raider, and promote them up to gunpowder units. So to get around that.
Oh, I'm glad we don't have that salt.
It was completely enough.
So I guess in this poll right now, the people who say no is currently leading at 18, followed by maybe at 11, and yes at 10. Maybe. Look, take a position on it. Don't say maybe. Make a choice.
Maybe is a good option for selecting if you want the one unique unit per leader, I guess.
In fact, I think it would be a very good idea to have one unique unit for Reader instead of Civilization. Come on, are you seeing Napoleon with Musketeers in real life? Or, let me see, Wins with Redcoats? It would be a very different history of the world, most surely.
Yes. I would have to say, I think the reason they didn't do that is balancing reasons. The unique units already were quite hard to balance. Every time you introduce a change unit for a specific civ, you have to make sure that each civ has approximately the same advantage gained from that change. And I know that there are people who hate playing certain civs because of their unique units. You know, people who don't rush early hate the Incas, for example. But adding two or three unique units per leader makes the already difficult challenge of balancing that leader even more difficult to balance. There were enough balance problems with the civ already, I think, that while it's fine for a mod, I think it was better that the original designers of Fraxis did not do it that way.
C4 is not balanced. C4 was never balanced.
Well, but I was saying, balance would be even worse if you threw that in.
Well, that's true. But the whole unique unit talk about what is better, what is worse, it changes completely when you change perspective. I might say that in multiplayer, when we see a Roman, we kill a Roman. You don't wait for him to get to ironworking.
Oh, yes. That came up in my last multiplayer game. I don't remember who I was playing as, but I was starting next to the Romans, and I'm like, oops. All right, take care of that right now.
But balance is not a very good reason, because the game was never balanced. It might make the game less balanced, I agree, but most of the things that we could do to the game in this moment would probably unbalance the game even more.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
I thought it was the best unique building, including Beyond the Sword. Alsark posted a contrary thread, weakest units and buildings, over at CFC. He wanted to do so to make some balance tweaks. So we thought that we would talk about what are the best unique buildings.
I have a confession to make. This was just really an excuse for a top 10 list.
Oh, God.
Oh, no.
Surprise, surprise.
I need more coffee.
And, of course, inevitably, there'll be some people, even on this panel, who disagree with what I say.
I disagree.
No. He wants to get it in now. I disagree. I want it on record.
What I will say before I do the top 10 list, I'm trying to keep some things in mind in terms of what was Dan thinking when he was creating the list. Well, something I haven't done with the top 10 list before, or at least before I started to read it, was give my criteria for the buildings that I chose. And, of course, right away some people will be like, oh, that's a stupid criteria, but I've got to have some kind of limiting factors here. First off, that the unique building does not become obsolete. It does not require more than one technology to be able to be built, and does not require another building to be built prior for it being able to be built. So keeping those things in mind, here is the top 10 from number 10 to number 1, because, of course, if I start at number 1, then people will really not be listening anymore. At number 10, the mausoleum, which is the Indian replacement for the jail. +2 happy, in addition to the +50% espionage and -25% war weariness you'd get with a jail normally. 120 hammers requiring constitution. Number 9 is the forum, the Roman replacement for the market. +25% great person birth rate in addition to +25% gold. 150 hammers available at currency. Number 8, the Ikonda for the Zulu, which is the barracks replacement, which gives you -20% maintenance in addition to the +2 happy with nationhood and the +3 experience for new land units. It's just 60 hammers, and it's available for building at the game outset. Number 7 is the dike from the Dutch, the levee replacement. +1 hammer on water in addition to the +1 on river tiles. Can only be built in a coastal or riverside city, but obviously 180 hammers available as steam power a little later on in the game. Number 6 is the grrr, which is the Mongolian replacement for the stable, which gives you +4 experience for new mounted units, not just +2. It's only 60 hammers and is available at horseback riding. Number 5 is the trading post, the Viking replacement for the lighthouse, where you get free navigation 1 promotion, which is a +1 movement range, for all naval units built by the city in addition to the +1 food on water tiles. Just 60 hammers available at sailing. Number 4, the mint from the Malinese, the forge replacement, +10 gold in addition to +25% hammers and the +1 unhealthy. Anyway, 120 hammers and available at metal casting. Number 3, the ball court from the Maya, which is the Colosseum replacement, +3 happy instead of +1, along with +1 happy per 20% culture rate, assuming you use that, but really the +3 happy there. Just 80 hammers and available at construction. Number 2, the Rathus, the Holy Roman Empire replacement for the courthouse, -75% city maintenance as compared to -50% in addition to +2 espionage points, 120 hammers and available code of laws, and yes, the fact that it was the Holy Roman Empire building, I didn't hold that against it. And so that brings me to, in my ranking of the top 10 unique buildings, the number one unique building on my list is the Sacrificial Altar, the Aztec replacement for the courthouse, -50% anger duration from sacrificing population, in addition to +2 espionage points and -50% city maintenance, just 90 hammers and available at Code of Laws.
I disagree.
You still have a builder bias, Dan, or you'd rate a gear higher. Keshix with extra promotions,
Yeah, Keshix with extra promotions is way up there. The extra happy from the ball court is quaint, but that's about as far as I can say with that one. I'm sorry.
The guy with the ball court still isn't going to do well against the mounted units now.
You listed probably 10 of the better ones there. Ikonda and Gurr both way higher, though. Ikonda, you start out Zulu, and you've got a decent amount of room to grow. The fact that you can have that 20% decrease in city maintenance cost from the beginning means you can start out with 8 or 9 cities pre-Code of Laws instead of only, 5. Builder or not, as long as you've got the room for the cities, that's really, really powerful. And, of course, the Gurr with that's one of the few times where the unique unit and the unique building combine together beautifully. It's probably one of the more overpowered things in the game, I would say.
Still tell them they'll nerf it.
No, I don't think they're working on any more patches.
Oh.
Well, I wonder, how do you forget the Byzantine unique building? The Hippodrome, if I recall correctly the name. That gives double happiness compared with the building that it substitutes. When you push the slider up and cuts more awareness, I agree with putting the Akanda way, way up. C4 is one of those games that if you start right, it's definitely difficult to lose the game. And if you, and the Akanda allows you to start the game right. I would probably put the deck down too, but it comes late and it's not exactly cheap. But it depends a lot of the maps, of course.
Oh yes, there's always situations and can, of course, very easily alter this. For instance, the trading post, if you're on one continent, you know, well, that might be beneficial, but it's not going to be as...
Game-breaking.
Yeah, some of these really make a difference depending on map type. That one and any of those seafaring ones are completely irrelevant on Pangaea.
Dan, your top 10 list sounded like you were trying to sell something. Now, only 90 hammers! Get it while it still can!
Yes. The dike. 7. Sets should be a little bit higher also. It is map specific, but as long as you're on a map that's got a decent amount of water and river combined, and as long as you're not either inland or on a coast that has no river, so you can't build the dike.
Its later game availability put it in the bottom half as opposed to the top half, as far as I was concerned.
If you're worried about early game availability, then you've got to put the Akanda at the very top. But it's not so late that it's not very useful. I think it's early enough that you can still get a lot of use for it if you're playing a single-player game. Obviously, in multiplayer, it's, you're not going to get that far in the game usually.
I think the general consensus here is, good list, Dan, in terms of items, but your order.
Pretty much.
Yeah, your order's out of order.
Happiness is not that important. Most players on in most maps have plenty of happiness as long as you play it intelligently. Certainly something that's valuable, but taking your entire unique building, comparing something that allows you to build 3 or 4 extra whole cities early in the game versus something that in the middle game gives you 1 or 2 additional happy phases, and you're already talking about 15 or something happy phases that you're getting from other things, not really that useful.
I prefaced everything with my criteria, and yeah, I still am more of a builder than a warmonger, and I know that still shows.
Pretty much.
Duck's favorite map type?
The one that lets me win.
I fully agree with that.
I don't know. I like continents. I'm boring.
You're boring.
Yeah.
Continents is for noobs.
Big and small is a lot of fun. I definitely think in Beyond the Sword, big and small is a good one. That was one of the best ones that they added. Particularly for multiplayer gameplay, I just don't play single player that much, so that's sort of my focus, but it gives you really, really good multiplayer gameplay, only occasionally screwing over one of the players.
Mm.
Yeah, that's what happened the last time I played when I was the one that got screwed over.
Yeah. Well, that was, of course, the problem with the Raw Saturday game, which is the frequent multiplayer game that I most commonly play. The first time we tried, I finally convinced them to stop playing Pangaea and play Big and Small for one game, and, of course, Raw is the one that ends up as the person screwed over. Well, you know, sitting by himself in the corner.
I'm never playing this again!
Yeah, we played it once or twice other, but...
I also like hemispheres. I mean, I like earthy, like, maps.
Yeah, I'm going to do a longer builder game. I like to have Terra, actually. I still like that one.
I kind of like Tectonics. It gives a really, really, sometimes really difficult maps, but it's very interesting. You don't have a blob of land surrounded by water of all sides, or 2 or 3, because let's face it, Pangaea, continents, even hemispheres are quite predictable. If you are like me and have seen 100, 200, 300 maps during the Lonely Hearts Club, you can see that Pangaea especially, it's quite repetitive. It's almost like it is the same map with a different tile or two. That's why I like Tectonics. I also like Planet Generator. That it's not a stock script, but it gives very interesting and very different maps. Lots of choke points, lakes, desert, and whatever. It makes the game more interesting, but in terms of balance for multiplayer, forget it. Nobody wants to start in the side of the map that has space for one good city and desert for 20 tiles or something like that.
Dan, didn't we have a Tectonics map the other day in multiplayer?
Yeah, it did end up being that way, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that the one where Rome was stuck on one end of the map and we were all over on the other end of the map?
Yeah, he was in the southwest portion. And we were up in the northeast, and I was closest, because I was farthest west on the continent in the northern hemisphere, and he was in the southern hemisphere. I must have been 25 tiles, anyway, away from him. But getting rid of the Romans before they could get to Praetorians, he didn't have those.
He didn't have fire.
If he'd expanded north instead of south, he would have had them. I don't know, that was... Yeah, we took care of him very quickly.
Rome without iron? Ooh, surprises.
At the risk of being referred to as a noob, The five types I play most often are Pangaea custom continents, lakes, islands, and hemispheres, but I plan to play more of Tectonics and Fractal instead of lakes and hemispheres. That's my plan.
Your New Year resolution, right?
Yeah, the New Year's still young. In the poll right now, Fractal is
winning.
I don't know. I never do well in the isolation map, so I can't really deal with Fractal.
Fractal's in the lead, followed by Continents.
Yay, Imran.
followed by Big and Small, and then the other, such as Tectonics, then Hemispheres, then Pangaea, and then Archipelago.
I wonder why.
Because whenever I try it, I get stuck in my own little archipelago, and all the AIs are all in this huge one where they all can communicate with each other in tech trade.
So you decide you're playing the Lonely Hearts Club there. There you go.
little.
Archipelago can actually be some really interesting games, particularly multiplayer games.
I've seen some games in Tectonics that it was really very hard match from time to time, too, but that's why most people don't like it. I remember seeing one in the Funny Screenshots thread that had, let me see if I recall it, Dead Land Tiles and Ocean Everywhere. Very interesting, isn't it? And the guy won. I don't remember how, but he won.
It reminds me of a Civ 3 archipelago map I got one time where I was stuck on a desert island in the middle of nowhere. And everybody else had normal stuff.
That is sad.
I got stuck on a one-tile island in multiplayer once.
Cool.
That actually turned out well, though.
Well, except that we lost it to a culture victory.
Well, yes, but still.
Yeah.
Your one-tile capital was not as bad as you thought it was.
It should have been a very, very full of excitement game, I assume.
It depends on your definition of excitement. And whether you were on the receiving end of it or not. Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at polycast@apolson.net.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at polycast.apolton.net.
They are quite good against frigates.
Not sure I've ever actually created a transport attacking force, but...
You can even give them attack upgrades. Sometimes it's amusing when you send them up against wooden ships.
That little tiny machine gun against a big wooden ship, and in a second, you see the wooden ship.
This has been episode 62 of Polycast, an official podcast from Fulton Civilization site. I'm Stel Makalua. With me again was, as usual, Dan Quick.
As always.
Imran Siddiqui.
Bye.
Our own Joe Snoopy 369 Batiste.
Bye.
Joining us again, James Robertson.
Seriously coffee deprived now.
And also Rolo.
Bye, people. See you next time.
So...
There will be a next time.
James and Joe, do either of you regret saying yes, you'd come back?
Well, I mean, I always regret saying yes to anything with you.
The only thing I regret is not moving my coffee pot into my office.
Wait, so you have an office and you don't have a coffee pot in it? That just doesn't make sense.
It's in the kitchen. It's like 10 feet away.
He usually has to get up for another cup of coffee.
Oh, that's far.
No. Coffee pot must be next to the desk or on the desk, preferably.
Oh, Imran Mackey, you going to come back for another episode? It's just assumed that it's
a I don't know.
Oh, we keep showing up. I like the screenshots that he has there where Barbarian State has won a cultural victory.
Can that happen?
It can happen.
It wasn't a cultural victory. I think it was a domination victory.
Domination, sorry.
It could theoretically happen. I can't imagine it happening unless you're playing a Barbarian scenario.
Even then.
What topic are we starting with there, Ricardo?
Not sure.
Okay, that's not one of the options.
How do you know?
Record date?
February 7th, 2009.
Sound clips copyright of Sioux 4, Warlords, and Beyond the Sword expansion packs.
EEN clip courtesy YouTube.
Copyright 2009. Pulton Civilization site at apulton.net.